Thank you, Brother Tom. And I'll turn it over to Brother Mark, who will deliver unto us our third class this afternoon entitled Life Under the Sun. Brother Mark. So we've talked about death, and well, if we were depressed about that, and we were hoping for any relief when it came to life, then we'll be sadly disappointed, because the preacher now turns to life and says, "Therefore I hated life." So he didn't think much to death, but he doesn't think much to life either. And in fact, there's two particular passages which are quite powerful here. Chapter 4, and let's have a look at that, the beginning of chapter 4. So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of the oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. So he looks at injustice in the world. And he sees people being oppressed, and he says, "That's not right. What can I make of that? How can I interpret that? What model do I have for understanding why that should be the case?" And what does he conclude? Verse 2, "Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive." And now, does he really mean that? Well, probably not. It's probably ironic, but it's quite a powerful irony, isn't it? This issue of oppression, the oppressions that are done under the sun, is so distressing to him that he's brought to say that it's actually better to be dead than to be alive. So if death was bad, well, life's even worse, he's saying. So we're going to have a look in this talk at what he has to say about life. Let's just stay with this passage a little bit longer. "Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead." And then in verse 3 he says, "Yea, better is he than both they which hath not yet been." So it's even better never to have been than to be living now and beholding the oppressions, or than to have lived and be dead. It's better just not to have known and not to have been there in the first place, to have seen the evil work which is done under the sun. And then, he goes on to another example in verse 4, which also distresses him. So it's pretty bleak, isn't it? Even we who have, we have models for understanding why there is oppression in the world. We understand why that is, because we have a doctrine of sin. Nevertheless, that doesn't. It has a real explanatory power, having that, but that doesn't mean that it's still not frustrating when we watch oppression and we wish it wouldn't happen, don't we? And we can get upset about it. So I think the point is a valid point that he makes. Let's go over to chapter 7, which is another of these death is better than life passages. Verse 1, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death better than the day of one's birth." Now, how do those two fit together? Isn't that a bizarre juxtaposition? And they're almost like two little proverbs, aren't they? A good name is better than precious ointment. And you can almost imagine this, and some people have suggested that this is actually a quotation of a known proverb. And, so you just happily reading along in Ecclesiastes, and you come across this proverb, you think, yeah, that's a nice little proverb, very wise. "A good name is better than precious ointment." So to have a good reputation is really, that's a really valuable thing in life. And then he suddenly puts next to that, "And the day of death better than the day of one's birth," and that is jarring. And you say, what has that got to do with a good name being better than precious ointment? If it's right that he is either quoting a piece of traditional received wisdom, or he's actually just made up a piece of wisdom, and a valid piece it is. I mean, it's fair enough to say a good name is better than precious ointment. But then what he does then is to deliberately create another piece next to it, which throws you off your stride and says, hang on a minute, what's all that about? And what is it about then? Well, if you're alive, no matter how good your reputation, doesn't take much to destroy it, does it? And yet, if you die, then your reputation is locked in. And who is the greatest Beatle? Well, just to take a worldly example, well, it's John Lennon. Why is it John Lennon? Because he's the one who died. And, you know, Paul McCartney went on to do all that other stuff. And so he locks in a legacy by his death. And, you know, it's this thing about quitting in a sport, isn't it? When you're at the top of your game and not letting people see the decline down when you're no longer as good anymore and you're not as good as you used to be, it's better to just finish it while you're at the top. Not that John Lennon particularly did that, but never mind. And I think in Ecclesiastes he's making exactly the same points. Great to have the good reputation, but one tiny bit of folly and you can spoil it all. But at least if you die and you have that good reputation, then no one can take it away from you. So the point that you think he's making, which is saying about how good it is to have a good reputation, he then sort of undercuts it, doesn't he, by saying, yeah, and if you really want a good reputation, you better die. And life's like that. Life's full of ironies of that kind. And that's quite clever then, isn't it, if that's what he's saying. That's quite subtle. And so he goes on in this vein. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. So he's advocating here then a sort of somber approach to life. And after having read Ecclesiastes, if the message of Ecclesiastes has really gone down, really sunk down into our hearts, then in a way you can't do much else other than that, can you? They have this recognition of what life at the level of life has to offer and what it's like. The absurdities, the inconsistencies, the unfairnesses, the vanities of human existence. It's full of them. Everywhere you turn, you can see these things. So, what the rest of the book does, or the rest of the words of the preacher do, by and large, when he's not talking about death, is to look at life under the sun, and to examine what human life is like. And there are a number of themes that come out that he keeps referring to. And one of those is the issue of reputation and what legacy you can leave behind you. A number of the themes that don't seem initially, a number of his themes spring from the theme of death. So he looks at what happens to what you've left behind when you die? Well, another man is going to have that, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? And isn't that a vanity? You know, I spent all this work collecting all this stuff, and now someone is going to take that and do whatever they will, and I can have no control over that because I'll be dead and gone. And who knows if my son will be wise or a fool? That's the point that he's making, and you know. Perhaps he knew something about what Rehoboam was going to be like when he wrote some of those words. So he's quite concerned about that, about legacy. I was listening to an interesting thing in the week, actually, about American millionaires. And someone had done a survey about who American millionaires are, and American millionaires are by and large not people who have inherited wealth, but they are first generation wealth creators. So people who work hard, basically, and have their own business or something, or have a lucrative career, and then who live frugal lifestyles, and they amass all this wealth so that they can then survive without working for a number of period of years. But then if you look at what happens to the second generation and the third generation after that, well, you find that the wealth all disappears. And why is that? Well, it's because your descendants spend it for you. And they don't work as hard as you did, because they're born now with a silver spoon in their mouth, and they think life's just for the living. They don't believe in hard work like you believed in. So this tape was saying that I happen to be listening to. And I just thought that was interesting, and that chimed with what he's saying in Ecclesiastes, because there are probably four passages or so in Ecclesiastes which deal with the matter of succession. And who knows whether my son will be wise, who knows what's going to happen, who knows if something's going to happen to me and my money or whatever I have is going to fall into the wrong hands. Isn't that a vanity? It's one of those inconsistencies, those unpredictabilities of life, and they mean that, you know, if there was something that I thought I could trust in, and yeah, I know why I'm doing this. I'm doing this so that the generations to come, and yet I have no idea what the generations to come will do. And a lot of Ecclesiastes is about pointing out you have no idea. And we'll come onto that as we go on. And the idea of a legacy, that's quite interesting. Apparently, Nietzsche once wrote a paper about the meaning of history, in which he compared human beings to cows. And he thought that it was much better to be a cow than to be a human being. And the reason why he thought that is because, you know, a cow just stands there in the field and he eats his grass. And he's perfectly, or she, I suppose, is perfectly happy to just be there chewing all day. And the cow knows nothing of eternity. And the cow knows nothing of future or past. He's just there in that moment eating grass, and there's nothing else to worry about. A cow is not concerned about its legacy. A cow is not concerned about when it might or might not be going to the abattoir. It's just being in that moment, and it's content. And human beings can never have that contentment in their lives under the sun. And the preacher made that point a long time before Nietzsche did, of course, and Nietzsche just dressed it up in a different way in talking about cows. Well, let's have a look in chapter 1. There's a couple of other verses I wanted to pick up there, which are... in which the preacher sets out his stall a little bit and tells us a little bit explicitly about the enterprise in which he's engaged. Chapter 1 and verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man, to be exercised therewith. So that's what he's doing then. He's looking at what human life is like, and he's going to search out and seek by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. And what he describes those things as being, he describes them as being a sore travail. Hard burden of work, of effort, travail that's been laid upon us. And of course God said that we would labour and travail in the sweat of our face, didn't he? Back in Genesis, and so there's another link there. And notice what the verse says, and we're going to develop this much more fully later on, but look what it says there. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. So when we find these vanities, and he's going to be pointing them out, left, right and centre, the vanities of death, the vanities of succession, the vanities of reputation and legacy, all the vanities you can think of in this life, and life is full of them, he says. How did they come about? God gave these vanities to the children of men to exercise them. Which is quite a staggering concept, isn't it? And we know it's right when you think about it. Who made life like it is? Well, of course, we got ourselves into this mess. But then God put us in the state that we're in the sense of that dying, vain life that we must lead. God has made life the way it is, in a sense. Yes, of course, we compound the problem and we make it worse, but God has given us this sore travail to exercise us. And we'll look at a number of other passages that are like that, and we'll go on to see that God has done that for a very deliberate reason. So that being faced with those vanities, being faced with that sore travail, we should say, what is the point of that? Is that all there is? Is that God having made man and woman as the peak of his creation? Is that really what God has destined for us? Or is there something else? Is there some other way to live? Is there some other hope for us? He's made the one so that we can appreciate the other, and so that we can feel after him and find him. So that's something we'll be returning to. Verse 14, I have seen all the works that are done. Well, sorry, I just wanted to make one other point. So he doesn't say, when he looks at all these vanities, he doesn't say all these vanities are random things that I've found in life. He doesn't say, and I looked at that and that was pointless and it was random and meaningless in that sense. He looks at these vanities and he says that God has given us this sore travail. It's not that these vanities occur in life by accident, as it were. This is all under God's control. Which is a very interesting concept. Right, let's read that next verse. Verse 14, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. And again, it's very inclusive, isn't it? I've seen it all. I've given my life to see it all, and this is what I conclude. What human life is in and of itself, as an end in itself, this is what it is. Now, then we've got this expression under the sun. So what do we do with that? Well, I mean, it's an important expression. It occurs 26 times or thereabouts in the book. And some other expressions like it also occur, like under heaven. It doesn't occur anywhere near as much. So what are we to make of that? Well, you sometimes hear it said that it's a kind of technical expression and that it means life without God. So the distinction is made by some interpreters between those who live their life under the sun. So the sun might be God. The sun might represent God. And we might live our lives under the sun with disregard for God, without regard for him. And then there are other people who see the sun, and they're the people who appreciate God. They're the wise. And that the whole of the book, there is this division between people under the sun and people who see the sun. And I used to think that too, and I actually wrote some articles in the Tidings, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, something like that. And I sort of went for that view. I'm less sure about that now than I used to be. Because although it's very clear that the expression under the sun is used in a dominant way, it's much less clear that there is a contrasting expression. You know, I think the idea of seeing the sun, as in being aware of God, I mean, I think that's only used maybe twice, and I think it's a little bit doubtful in those passages whether you can really detect that a distinction is being made between God-fearers and people who are worldly people, let's say, living without God. There are examples of the phrase under the sun being used in other literature of the time, in which it means people, it just means people living their lives. So it's an important expression in Ecclesiastes, but I'm no longer persuaded that it's sort of a key to the book whereby you divide the world into two camps, those under the sun and us who understand God, because there's so little of the other relative to the point under the sun. So as I said, as I said before, it's pretty clear that the words of the preacher are concerned about life without a knowledge of God's ultimate plan and purpose, and without an understanding of the kingdom and of resurrection and ultimate reward in that way. So whether or not Solomon knew about that or believed it, we don't have any information about that from Ecclesiastes itself, I think, from the words of the preacher itself. But that's not what the preacher is writing about. But he is writing about life on its own terms, whether or not someone believed in God or a God. Hope that makes some sense. The danger that I was worried about falling into in this talk was that it would be very bitty. So you know, we're going to look at what life under the sun is like, as well as, you know, there's 50 different things that we might talk about. All sorts of different aspects of life under the sun. But actually, if you go through Ecclesiastes sort of systematically and try to group things into major themes that he talks about, there aren't actually that many. You know, he comes back to the same dominant ideas again. Or, you know, he looks at a slightly different example, but it's a bit related to something that he's already talked about. So the legacy, you know, what you leave behind you, we've got to say four or so passages about that. We've seen a chain of passages about death. We would find a chain of passages about labour and the advantages of or otherwise of labour. So what we're going to do is we're just going to look at three topics for the remainder of this talk. We're going to have a look at what he says about wisdom. We're going to have a look at what he says about justice, and then what he says about the limits of our knowledge and understanding of life and how things work. So what we're doing when we're looking at these things, we're talking about life on its own terms. We're talking about life in and of itself without regard to God's ultimate purpose in resurrection and the kingdom and so forth. What has life got to offer in and of itself? So let's see what he has to say about wisdom. Just want to finish off in chapter 1 for a second, because that introduces us to this theme. Let's have a look at verse 15. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. Now, I'd like to use that as a little springboard to talk about an important topic in the interpretation of the book. And that is the contradictions. I mentioned contradictions in the first talk. There's a number of places where you can take one verse and you can set another verse against it and say, hang on a minute, this doesn't seem to be consistent. And how do we deal with that? Well, humans have exercised their ingenuity, as they do, to deal with that. And so people try to reconcile. People generally have tried to reconcile some of these contradictions. You might have one passage which seems to say wisdom's really good, and another one that says, yeah, wisdom's actually not so good. So what could you do with that? Well, you could say, oh, well, this one's talking about spiritual wisdom, and this one's talking about worldly wisdom. And then you've got no contradiction. Did you see? That's a simple strategy for reconciling two passages about wisdom. Or another thing that you can do is you could say, well, this passage that says wisdom's not very good, and I'm just creating examples to illustrate the point here. The passage that says wisdom's not very good, you can say, oh, well, that's not what he really thought. He's just quoting someone else at that point. Yeah. So that's another way in which you can reconcile the passages. And there was some rabbi, I don't know when it was, but who came up with a whole a whole series of points. You know, here are four principles by which you can, you know, with my special tools, you can reconcile all the passages in Ecclesiastes, and you can almost imagine it on the home shopping network. And then someone else came along and said, well, actually, those four points aren't enough. Here are another three, but if you have my seven tools, then you really can do it. But I think, actually, they're missing the point. Because you remember how we talked about the term vanity was about, one of the meanings of that was absurd in the sense of not fitting together, not matching up in the way that you would expect them to. You know, if you had created a system of things, you wouldn't have made it quite that way. You wouldn't have left what seemed to be these dislocations, because you wouldn't have been as wise as God, actually. But that's how the way the world is, and it doesn't always seem to make sense to me or to you. We can't get to the bottom of how things are or why things are the way they are in every case, and we're only fooling ourselves if we think we can. So should we be surprised, given that the preacher is finding all these things that are difficult to understand, should we be surprised if they don't necessarily reconcile? Should we be surprised to find contradictions? No, we shouldn't be surprised. That's exactly what we should expect to find, because that illustrates the very vanity he's trying to describe. So he says, you know, I know there will be a judgment, and yet, oh, I know it's better to be, wise than to be foolish, and yet, here are some foolish people who seem to be doing really well, and here's some wise people who seem to be downtrodden. Those things don't seem to match. And they don't seem to match, do they? And as I say, we have a model for understanding that, but on the surface, they don't seem to match. And his point is that they don't seem to match, and that it's difficult to deal with those things. So if we try to reconcile them and say, oh, actually they do match, then we're missing the point that he's trying to make. So I think we need to be careful with that reconciling approach to the book. And when he says here, that which is crooked cannot be made straight, I think in a way that's useful as a kind of little maxim for thinking about how we interpret the book. Let's not just go through it and try to sort of smooth over all the cracks, as it were, to impose on it a message that we want it to have, rather than the message that it might actually be saying. Let's carry on. Verse 16, I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yet my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. And in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So you wouldn't have expected that, would you? You'd have expected that if you'd got all that wisdom that he had, and if you'd done all those experiments that he had done, you'd reckon that you'd feel pretty good about yourself. And you'd say, well, that was a job well done. That was really interesting to have done that. And yet, paradoxically, he finds himself being vexed of spirit. He finds himself finding that in much wisdom is much grief. And he doesn't define what kind of wisdom it is that he's talking about there. So, you know, he leaves that for the interpreter to do, which is quite interesting, quite challenging. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. And I think, you know, again, using the frame as a help, we can conclude that he's not talking about the wisdom which says, fear God and keep his commandments. He's not talking about the wisdom of God's plan and the kingdom and all that, because we've seen that's not in his frame of view. But yet, what wisdom he is talking about isn't specified. But one thing that he must be saying is, after all that effort, after all that attempt to try to understand how the world works and what life is like, he finds himself weary and he finds himself unable to do it. He doesn't have a powerful enough explanatory scheme to be able to do so. Let's then get into a couple of wisdom passages. So first, our first theme then, how long have we got left? Our first theme then is wisdom, and we just want to shoot through a couple of passages here. Chapter 2 and verse 13 and 14. Then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. Okay, so wisdom is much better than folly. Agree with that. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And that, again, is something that could be like a proverb, couldn't it? The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. That's a little wise and pithy saying that one could take around with you. It may even be a quotation. But then he says, but I myself, and now he comes in with the thing that undercuts what he's just said, I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. So that wisdom, whatever kind of wisdom that was, it didn't stop them both having the same end, because God has decreed that end should happen to everyone. And so that puts a limit, then, in a sense, on that wisdom. Verse 15. Then I said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. So he's feeling to himself, what's the point? Why did I do all that work? I went to so much trouble to become wise like this, and I'm just going to be laid in the grave like a sheep, just like the man who didn't bother. How frustrating is that? That's the point that he's making. Verse 17 and 18. Therefore I hated life. We've had a look at that one already. Verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labour which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall come after me. There's the succession issue that we talked about before. So, let's look at another passage, chapter 8 and verse 1. Who is as the wise man, and who knoweth the interpretation of the thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. So there's a good positive verse in praise of wisdom. So wisdom's a good thing. And that's typical of his style. And we saw what the yeah but was before in chapter 2. It was but one event happeneth to them all. And now in chapter 9, let's have a look at chapter 9 and verse 13. This wisdom have I seen under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. And this is now a case study. There was a little city, and a few men within it, and there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. So you have a little city with a few men, and you have a great king coming against it with these huge bulwarks. So the little city doesn't have any hope of survival, you would think. And yet, verse 15, now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Wow, that's how powerful wisdom is. Little city, few men, poor wise man, and yet, because of wisdom, he can deliver the city from that great king with his bulwarks. That's impressive. So that's in praise of wisdom. And yet, then what does he say? And yet, no man remembered that same poor man. Nobody cared afterwards. Once they were safe, they just forgot about him. How come the world is like that? Should the world be like that? Is that frustrating? Is that vanity? Of course it is, and he's just pointing it out for us. So there's a limit to wisdom there. It's all very well in being wise and saving a city, but if no one remembers it afterwards, I wonder if the man thought, why did I bother? So he's undercutting what he's just said. So he concludes, verse 16, then said I, wisdom is better than strength. So that's his conclusion. Wisdom is better than strength. I can see that wisdom is better, and yet, nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. And that's a vanity. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. So here's a positive point again. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Another positive point. But one sinner destroyeth much good. So there's all this wisdom, but then you get one sinner and he spoils it all for everybody. So you see, he's gone positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, positive, negative. And he set these things, he's juxtaposed all these things together. And he says, make sense of that if you can. That's a vanity. That's the way life is. And those were the passages we were going to have a look at about wisdom. I mean, chapter 10 is like that too. We won't look at the references now. But chapter 10 is largely a chapter which is in praise of wisdom. And he gives various examples of the power of wisdom, why it's good to be wise, how to be wise. But tucked away in the middle of it, verses 5 to 7, he undercuts it all and says, but... So what conclusions do we draw from that? Well, we say it's a frustrating thing living here. This is a sore travail that God has given us to be exercised with. And so we should lower our expectations. If we are wise, we should lower our expectations about what that will mean as far as how other people will respond to it. And you know, when we think about worldly wisdom and earthly wisdom and, the wisdom of education and such things, we should think about the limits of that then, because Solomon's pointed out very clearly the limits of wisdom. So, you know, let's not devote all our lives and energies to that, because ultimately it's a vanity and it will be undercut by some foolish man coming along and destroying much good. So let's think about, what we're going to pay attention to, what we're going to give our lives and our energies to, what kind of wisdom will we devote ourselves to. So wisdom and its limits. Yes, wisdom is good, but. Let's go on to the second theme, which is justice. And we won't look at this passage, but in chapter 10, there's a nice passage from... sort of verses 8 to 10, so where he goes up, cause and effect. You know, there are consequences for everything. There's a consequence. And we should be aware of that there are consequences for our actions, and the whole principle of judgment is built upon that premise, that there are consequences for our actions. So that might be a broad principle, which is broadly true, and it might be broadly true that... It might be broadly true that there is a link between some kind of morality, some kind of ethical standards, and success. That may or may not be true. But there are plenty of exceptions. If it is true, there are plenty of exceptions to it. And if it was true for Israel on a national level, as Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26, is it? As they teach, and as I think the book of Proverbs teaches, if that's true on a national level, there are certainly cases on an individual level, even amongst the Jewish people, where it wasn't true. And it's not just Ecclesiastes that laments that. The book of Psalms laments it too. Have a look at Psalm 94, for example. We won't do that now, but that's a psalm on the same theme. So it should be no surprise to us then when in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 we see at verse 16 and 17, "And moreover, I saw under the place of under the sun, the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there." And that's hard to deal with, isn't it? It's hard to deal with. It requires faith to deal with that. And he now brings that faith out in verse 8 to 17. "I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work." So in due time, that will be addressed. But at the moment, it's a vanity, it's a frustrating thing, it's an absurdity that's hard to rationalize and to deal with. Let's have a look at chapter 7 again. Two more passages on justice before we come to our final theme. Justice chapter 7 and verse 15. All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his wickedness. So, I mean, Job makes that argument, doesn't he, as well, in the book of Job. And you can't correlate the two things, that being righteous means that you're going to have a good life here and now, necessarily. And yet there might be some intrinsic feeling in us that it ought to be like that, but it isn't like that in many cases. And so he says, verse 16, be not righteous overmuch, neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldst thou destroy thyself? I'm not quite sure what to do with that verse. I mean, maybe you should interpret it as being like self-righteous or being a kind of goody-goody. Don't know. Maybe it's a kind of maybe he's advocating a kind of pragmatic approach with respect to, you know, what goes on in life and the sort of expectations that we should have. It's something that clearly can't be true ultimately with respect to our spiritual ambitions. There's no doubt about that. The rest of the scriptures make that very plain, don't they? So, you know, we need to have some kind of context for interpreting that verse. I'm not quite sure what that context is, but those are some suggestions. Let's have a look at chapter 8 and verse 9. All this have I seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time where one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. And I saw the wicked who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city wherein they had so done. This is also vanity. So, you know, the wicked are dead and buried, and they seem to have got away with it. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of man is fully set in them to do evil. So that's the problem. The problem of injustice in the world, which is hard to deal with, and which is a component of the vanity which is in this earthly life on its own terms. And yet, he makes, nevertheless, the conclusion of faith in verse 12. Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, because he feareth not before God. So he comes to say, well, I know that ultimately that will be addressed. And he doesn't specify how it's been addressed, because that's not the focus of his book. He says it will be addressed. But then in verse 14, he comes back again to the frustrating thing of the present. There is a vanity which is done under the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. This also is vanity. So after having expressed a solution, he loses himself again in the problem. And that's where he leaves his readers. Why does he do that? Because he's making the point about the vanities of this life and what life under the sun is like. So, there we are. Those are two of the themes. Let's come to the final one. The unknowableness of life, the inscrutability of life, and we want to be for this mainly in chapter 7 and chapter 8. Chapter 7 and verse 13. Consider the work of God. Notice that. What are we considering here? We're considering the work of God. Remember, it was God who gave this sore travail to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. So it's a very important point that then, and I made it before, but I want to make it again because it's so key to the reasoning of the preacher. Life isn't like this by accident. Life isn't full of these vanities and injustices by accident. Of course, we triggered it being like this with our sin. But God has decreed that life should be like this. Consider the work of God. Because he made it. He made us, and he made the world in which we're in. Who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Let's not be too confident that we can rationalize everything, that we can reconcile everything, that we can explain how and why everything is as it is in this life. Let us certainly be confident in God's plan and that he is in control, and what he teaches us about himself and about us and about where the world is going and about his kingdom, let us certainly be confident in that. But let us not be so confident that we can explain everything about how things are in this world now. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight that which he hath made crooked? In the day of prosperity be joyful, but in the day of adversity consider. God also hath set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. So he sets these things that don't seem to fit together, these dislocations, these things that seem to bang against each other and cause tension. He's done that on purpose to make us think. Let's look at some more of these verses because they'll help us get a bit further into this. Verse 24. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? So a similar theme here about the limits of our knowledge. He gave his heart to it. He didn't do anything else apart from try to understand it all. And he couldn't get there. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? And we'll look a bit more at that passage at the end of chapter 7. I think at the start of the next talk. Let's go over to chapter 8 for a couple of important verses there. Chapter 8 and verse 16 and 17. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for there is that neither day nor night giveth sleep with his eyes, seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God. So there it is again. It's the work of God who made life as it is. I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. And this is a great one, I love this point. Because though a man labour to seek it out, as the preacher certainly laboured, yea, he shall not find it. Have you got that point? He says implicitly, rhetorically. Well, if you haven't got it, I'm going to make it again. Yea, father, though a wise man think to know it, if you think you've got it, yet shall he not be able to find it. So don't kid yourself, he's saying. And there are also a lot of other passages about the limits of our knowledge in Ecclesiastes that we don't have time to go through. We'll finish in 11 and verse 5. So we must beware of arrogance here, you know, about pat explanations about things and why things are how they are. 11 and verse 5, as thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit. Whether he's talking about the wind or whether he's talking about the Spirit as his power, both would be relevant, and the word's ambiguous. Nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child. Even so, thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. Even so, thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. What we have to do is to trust that the way in which he has made things is the right way, and that this sore travail that he has given us to be exercised therewith is the right trial for us at this time in order to develop and to prepare us for the glory which by his grace will follow.